sometimes behave so strangely. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the So Strangely podcast, a podcast on recent research in music and science. Today, I'm joined by Professor Bryn Hughes in the Faculty of Fine Arts at the University of Lethbridge. Hi, Bryn.
Hello.
How's it going?
I'm fantastic. I'm really looking forward to this.
All right. Well, today, you recommended Chris White's recent paper on relationships between tonal stability and metrical accents in monophonic contexts, published in 2017 in Empirical Musicology Review. So let's get our listeners oriented a bit. What is this area of research?
So this is a study that Chris did to test essentially an assumption that we have in music theory, where we think that tonal hierarchy and metrical hierarchy are more or less aligned. So the tonal hierarchy, if you're not familiar, is something that has been written about a lot, perhaps is in this sort of music science area, generally speaking, most famously brought forward by Carol Krumhansel's work. And the general findings of tonal hierarchy studies are, when you're within a key, there are certain pitches that are more stable than others and sort of form a hierarchy. And if you look at any of the illustrations that come along with this, you'll find a very common thing. And this is found in Chris's article as well, where the first, third, and fifth scale degrees kind of are the most stable. And then the rest of the notes within the key are slightly less stable. And then the notes that are outside of the key within the chromatic space are the least stable. Along with that, the metrical hierarchy, I guess, has also been studied quite extensively. There's a common way of explaining this, at least that's become common, drawn from the work of Laerdal and Jackendoff's 1983 book, A Generative Theory of Tonal Music. And in that book, they talk about metrical hierarchy as, well, most music that is metrical or that has sort of rhythm and meter has a series of strong and weak pulses. And those pulses kind of group together hierarchically so that each strong pulse is a pulse at a sort of higher metrical level. For example, in a measure of, say, 4-4, if you hear a pulse at the eighth note level, the first of each of those pairs of eighth notes would be considered a strong pulse. The higher level, that would create quarter notes, and the first and third of those quarter notes are considered strong quarter notes, and at the higher level, those would create half notes, and the first of those two half notes would create a whole note, and so on. One of the things that we talk about in music theory is the idea that sort of tonally stable things happen in metrically stable places. So mm-hmm. The pitches that we have that we consider to be stable would also occur on stable parts of the metrical hierarchy. And so this study seems to sort of test that assumption that we sort of expect these things to happen in alignment. And it was, I think it's a really important thing to do because there's so much in music theory that we kind of assume is mm-hmm. true. And we pass along to our students that, you know, this is the way that music works. And I think the reason that I got into this area of research is to kind of test those assumptions. And so this is one of those studies that I just find to be really important because it tests those sort of fundamental things that we're passing along to future musicians, and we should always be careful to think and to research these things, think about them, make sure that we're not passing on things that aren't true.
So tonal hierarchy is often sort of in parentheses of this is a particular hierarchy is suitable for a particular type of music, and certainly there are different cultural practices that have different types of hierarchy, and even types of music that have been developed specifically to resist the establishment of any kind of hierarchy of some notes are more important or some notes are more stable or some notes tend towards others. These relationships between notes have been challenged in the context of melodies, in the context of musical works.
Absolutely.
From a bunch of different angles. But one of the great attractive things about tonal hierarchy is that not only has it been something that people use in the way in which they write music and talk about music from a theoretical perspective, but it's been validated by a bunch of different approaches to Western tonal music. You know, it's been validated by these priming experiments where you give people like a sequence of notes or a melody and you orient them towards some kind of tonal context, like you give them a major scale and then they will prefer notes that will suit the scale or that will suit the what is predicted as appropriate to continue based off of what we know should follow on theoretical, on tonal grounds from the harmony. So it's been a very satisfying thing to have the science validate that part of music theory. And corpus studies have found that, you know, the notes that are more important often occur most frequently within specific corpuses. Though there's fun little challenges in there when you get into the details.
Right. But. Well, and I think that the elephant in the room, I think you mentioned this. I really appreciated that you said Western tonal music so clearly there because... Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that a lot of this is founded upon is the fact that it looks only at Western tonal music and the sort of assumptions of Western tonal music. And there's obviously a problem with that, right? There are lots of non-Western musics that perhaps don't behave in the same way. And
there's even Western musics that don't behave in the same way.
Precisely,
I mean, you study rock music, you study pop music, and
right,
the
exactly.
rules change. Or at least that's what we think.
Right.
I don't
know. Yeah, well, that's...
I don't know where the science is. But.
Some of my research is dealing with exactly that question. I think this is part of the reason why I wanted to look at Chris's work is that, you know, some of it overlaps with mine in that way, and that some of the findings that were discussed in his paper, I think might help inform some of that in my research too. So I'm very keen to talk to him.
In the context of a lot of the studies that look at these relationships between metrical hierarchy and tonal hierarchy, actually, there's not a lot that look at their relationships.
No, and that's why this is such an exciting paper.
Yeah. But a lot of the studies that look at tonal hierarchy and metrical hierarchy try to get at very basic relationships by simplifying the potential for influence on one particular factor or another particular factor. And so oftentimes we have very simple studies of you hear like a sequence of beats, or you might even hear a sequence of beeps that don't change at all. And then we see what people's minds will add to that or how people engage with that. And so that's the paradigm that we're working with here, is that tradition of taking things that we understand from complex musical contexts and simplifying them to the most controlled, as much as possible, the most controlled settings, and then seeing how a tweak in this direction or a tweak in that direction might influence how people interpret them. All right, so just quickly to give an outline of this paper, I'm going to do it this time, and then Bryn, you get a chance to do it after we talk to Chris.
Okay.
So this paper describes a sequence of four studies, and the first three focus on the potential for influence on how people recognize metrical hierarchy given different harmonic or tonal cues. And the first one uses traditional Western music context. It's a major scale context. And then the question is, well, would tonal strength provoke in listeners a sense of metrical strength? And then the next two studies use artificial contexts using statistical exposure sequences. So foreign combinations of notes that lean towards one particular note or towards a particular set of notes that might encourage people to recognize that these notes are stable, are salient, and to test whether that then would have an influence on what notes are considered metrically strong. And then in the last study, this is flipped around, and the question is then whether or not things that can be recognized as metrically strong would influence how people interpret the harmonic context of what's going on. Would people interpret the appropriate harmony based off of which notes are perceived as stronger, given a manipulation that's very well established in beat perception, which is making one note a lot louder than the other one. Pretty consistently, people will think of the loud note as strong compared to a quiet note. And so using that manipulation, the question was, well, then how are people perceiving a harmonic context based off of that? And so all of these different interactions are looked at in the sequence of studies, and we get some interesting interesting results out of that. Namely, that principally there wasn't a strong effect of tonality on the perception of metrical hierarchy, but there was an interesting effect of metrical hierarchy on the perception of tonal contexts. And so we will get into the details as we discuss with Chris. Now, Bryn, you've talked a little bit about why these results are exciting to you. Do you want to say anything more on that topic?
The lack of results, I guess, in the first three, I shouldn't say lack of results, but the fact that the first three experiments didn't confirm the assumption that tonality would inform metrical hierarchy, I think is surprising. In music theory, anyway, we kind of have this assumption that, the tonal hierarchy is kind of what looms large over everything else. And the fact that this is not the case in regards to this experiment is really, really surprising and important to bring out. I always come back to what I'm teaching my students. And, you know, we spend so much time on tonality and on the notes and on the pitches. And it's somewhat refreshing to sort of see research that says, hey, maybe this isn't the most kind of important thing that we're focusing on. Yeah. And sort of the flip side of things in that last experiment, I thought was, again, really, really interesting that in fact, I talk about this a lot when I talk about tonal ambiguity. Well, how do we make something sound like the tonic if
it's unclear from the context?
If we don't have a total context for it, then to the fact that a metrical hierarchy and metrical emphasis can really sort of make something sound like the tonic kind of confirmed a lot for me about what I've been thinking about specifically with tonally ambiguous music, in particular popular music, where we get a lot of sort of tonal ambiguous four chord loops and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think this is an exciting paper for those reasons and lots others. I'm sure Chris will enlighten us with.
All right. Well, let's bring Chris onto the call then and see what all he has to say about how this experiment came about and what he thinks is exciting about what comes out of it as well. And now we are joined by Professor Chris White, and he is from the Department of Music and Dance at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. So, Chris,
hello.
How are you feeling about this paper?
It's interesting to talk about it because it's my first foray into behavioral studies, actually.
Mm-hmm. When I saw that your name was on this paper, I was like, oh, he's changed gears. Because you've mostly worked on corpus studies and looking at the sequential relationship between harmonies. What drew you to finally testing humans?
What led up to this paper was that I was working on corpus analysis of harmony stuff. Mm-hmm. And I was working on a key finding model. And I was finding that the key finding model works better when you add metric information into it. And so then I started to look at what metric models there are out there. And so I was playing around with it, and I wanted to see whether I could do a metric model with just harmony. Mm-hmm. So like looking at the series of harmonies that are occurring in a piece of music, can you create a computer program that identifies what the stronger beats are? Or what the metrical hierarchy would be. And
just quickly, what kind of music are you working on in this case?
Oh, yeah. So we're working with common practice Western European music for this.
Okay. So Western concert music from
1650 to 1900. I mean, that's what's going on in my corpus, at least. So my corpus is that I was working on with this is classicalarchives.com, which runs from, roughly Bach to roughly Mahler.
Okay. Bach to Mahler. That's a nice range. That's
Yeah. It's a range, but it's also like it's user generated. So it's, what people's favorite piece of music is, they midify it and then they upload it to the website. So it's a big, hodgepodge of stuff from a pretty long period of time.
Okay.
So playing around with trying to do meter finding with harmony, and I got to a place where I could get it to work pretty well, but it didn't work as well as like an accent-based model. But what that got me to wondering was whether, so I can find this corpus property that says that certain harmonies tend to occur on strung beats, but do we actually use that as listeners when we figure out what a strung beat is, especially if like computationally accent works better. Does that mean that when we're in the real world, we just always use accent instead of using harmony?
So by accent, you mean pitch height, ornaments, loudness?
I actually mean mostly loudness.
Okay.
like if you just use loudness or proxies for loudness, like the number of notes that are attacking, the mm-hmm. number of note onsets at any given point in time, mm-hmm. like that goes a really long way. You can get upwards of 90-95% accordance with a ground truth using mm-hmm. just loudness. Mm-hmm. Yeah, whereas harmony is like, you know, 60 or 70%, like better than okay. chance, but it's not yeah. it's no loudness.
Yeah. Yes, loudness trumps so many things. It's yeah, always as right. if that's like perceptually salient or something. I don't know.
Yeah, and as theorists, we hate this. Mm. Like, we really want it to be harmony. We don't want it to just be as simple as like what's louder. We want something more interesting to be there. Yeah. And so, like as a theorist, I was really interested in trying to figure out whether it is a thing that listeners do, whether listeners do listen for particular harmonies or mm-hmm. tonal stability or something like that when they mm-hmm. do meter finding.
So you ended up developing these four different studies. Now, when I read the paper, to me, it reads like study one gave you a result and you went, and then study two gave you another result and you went, oh, and then you developed study three and then you developed study four. Is that really how it happened? Or did you have like a long-term research plan in mind when you got started?
Chronologically, actually, what we started with was experiment two.
Oh, so that was the study where you created a fake tonal context based off of just two notes and then yeah. tested to see how people perceived which was metrically strong in an alternating sequence.
Yeah. Okay. And then when that didn't work, I thought, well, that's surprising. Let's mm-hmm. do something that will clearly work, mm-hmm. which is taking melodies where, or like these, you know, scare quote melodies, where one note is more stable than the other, and I have people tap what they hear as the strong pulse. In my head, I was like, this is absolutely going to work. Uh-huh. And then it didn't.
Yes.
And so then I go back and I do the study experiment two with this 30-minute exposure session, mm-hmm. and that didn't work either.
So then you went to standard tonality.
Yeah, then we flipped it for experiment four. Because, like, I mean, one of the other larger questions that's floating over this is whether meter influences tonality, right? Mm-hmm. Like, writ large, whether meter helps us know what key something's in, mm-hmm. but then also whether knowing the key that something's in helps us know what the meter is. Mm-hmm. And so I wasn't getting results from one direction. The key didn't help people know what the meter was, and so I wanted to flip that and see whether we'd get results going the other direction.
Mm-hmm. When you started these studies to look for metrical hierarchy, you used a tapping task to ask mm-hmm. people to identify which were the strong beats. How did you choose this particular way of identifying metrical hierarchy?
For a couple of reasons. First off, because it's simple. Mm-hmm. So I've had the pleasure of working in large state school music departments. And one of the things that you just have an abundance of is music students just sort of milling around. And so when I think about experimental designs that I can use, I want uh-huh. to come up with simple tasks that students can do in 5 minutes or so.
Yeah.
And a tapping yeah. task is a really good, like, simple task that you can explain quickly and they can do quickly.
So you felt like that was a safe way of getting at this question. Of course, if you're working with music students, you could also just ask them in words, which
yeah.
is not something you can do with other types of participants. You know, if you asked a student, well, where is the strong beat? Do you think you would have had the same answer?
No, Finn, that's a really good point, because one of the prompts that I gave them was, I said, imagine this music in 2-4.
Okay.
Tap on what you hear as the downbeat.
Okay, so you were explicit about that.
I was explicitly relying on their, you know, musically trained background. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I worry about, you know, what keeps me up at night uh-huh. is in popular music, you clap on, you don't clap on 1 and 3, you clap on 2 and 4, right? And so there's this yeah. physical activity, this yeah. A proxy for a tapping test that happens on the off beats, right? Mm-hmm. And so you could imagine that if you're bringing that sensibility to this, mm-hmm. people could have just as well been tapping on 2s and 4s.
But you did ask them specifically. I mean, I think it is fair to say that unless your participants were bad participants, which there's always that possibility. But, you know, compared to other populations, this was a group of people that had a better opportunity for playing by your rules.
That's right. I mean, that's one reason that I like to rely on music students is not just because I have them around, but just because, like, I can, because I also am assigning them what they're doing in theory class.
Yes.
I know what they're listening to. You
know? At the very least.
I know some of what they're listening to. Yeah.
During the tapping tasks, how often did people shift? Did they really, were they consistent once they started tapping on a particular note, or did they shift around every 4 or 5 taps? What were they doing actually in that sequence of action?
Yeah, I don't have the specific numbers, but my impression is that most of the times when there's a drift, it's because they are just physically getting more attuned, like sluggishly tapping the space bar at the beginning. The computer thinks that they're tapping on a different pulse than they mean to be. And then when they get like actually into it, it aligns.
Okay. There might be like ambiguity initially or a tentativeness in how they're expressing meter, but then it can get firmly established as opposed to people like switching up meter and flipping their perception of weak beats and strong beats after they've kind of established one of them.
Like informally after the experiment, plenty of people say something like, I just didn't really know which one to tap. But what I don't hear ever is people saying that they switched halfway through.
Okay.
Just anecdotally, people have felt like they chose one.
Part of this process that you undertook was to work with alternative tonal hierarchies. I mean, when we talk about Western tonality and the way in which the ear is formed, there is this assumption that, you know, we come with this by adult stage, nearly hard-coded feeling of where's your tonic, how to hear things in this standard, like, major scale, minor scale formulation of music. But there has been this growing area of using artificial alternative tonalities to try to get at how we learn different tonal hierarchies and how we work with them. So when you decided to work with alternative tonal hierarchies, like, what was your process there?
What I wanted to do was, so let's imagine for a second that I had gotten positive results from this. What I would have been able to say is that outside of Western tonality, there's like a general tendency to tap on or to entrain to the more frequent pitch.
Yeah.
And so I wanted something as general and as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. And so making just a two note scale that's symmetrically divided as the tritone is, like speaks to that generality.
Mm-hmm. But what you got was so much more interesting than that, in that not only did you not get people tapping mostly on the more frequent note, you also didn't really get people tapping on the less frequent note either. It was nearly evenly split. I mean, if there is a slight effect there, it's minuscule, and people were fairly free to tap on, you know, the more frequent note or the less frequent note. It was really up to them to assign what any kind of, you know, hierarchy they felt like in that context.
Yeah, and in fact, they tapped on the higher pitch more, right, in this particular experiment. And the thing that was worrying me about this was that whether they were, like, listening at all, like, whether there was any effect of them, you know, sitting and listening to these tritones for however long it was, 5 minutes in the first one and 30 minutes in the second one, which is why I stopped the experiment and restarted it and had them audiate what they heard as tonic or the more stable pitch, just so that I could prove that something was happening.
Yeah, that was a really nice intervention. I liked that you could demonstrate that, no, they did have a sense of what was the more salient, stable, persistent pitch, even if they didn't care when it came to assigning a metrical hierarchy.
Right.
Your presentation of these results actually was also really striking to me, in that you deliberately put forward effect sizes right from the beginning.
I was really, really taken by that too, actually. I don't think I've ever seen that before.
I mean, I think that we're trained to fetishize p-values, and I feel like bringing in expected effect size is an important, like, complement to whether something is statistically significant.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that also, like, suggests why does this experiment have 20 people as opposed to 30 people as opposed to 10 people.
Yeah.
Right. You don't want to just be like, well, it's because I had 20 people around me. You want it to be for a particular reason. I think that it adds motivation to the number of participants. Cause also like you could worry that somebody is just like adding participants to their study until they get a significant effect. Right.
Yeah. Like that's p-hacking.
And so coming out at the beginning of something and saying, well, we expected this effect size, and so we had 20 people do this, is a, I guess I like that framing. I can't take credit for it. It was me working with the beautiful and brilliant statisticians at UNCG and at UMass here. Both schools have great statistical consulting groups where you know, humanities and social science professors can set up appointments and go and talk. And I highly suggest anybody that's doing work in humanities departments or social science departments who haven't like spent their PhD rummaging through interesting statistical tests to talk to these people.
I could certainly use something like that. That's a wonderful resource to have. I know what you mean, spending time rummaging through things. I feel like I spend the better part of every one of my days just looking through Stack Overflow comments for figuring out how to do things in R by myself. But I should probably just look to see if I can find somebody who can help me with this.
Yeah, you get a different conversation.
Yeah.
If you bring someone the whole experiment rather than trying to solve problem sort of line by line.
Chris, can I ask you about the effect size in particular? Like, again, I'm not a statistician, and so I don't know, but it seems like predicting an 80% effect size is really, really high. It says, given the literature surrounding tonal metric hierarchies, we hypothesize that the preference for more stable pitches would yield an 80% effect size. That seems huge for me.
No. I mean, that's a totally reasonable response to have. The reason that I had it was because that somewhat mimics the difference in frequency that you would expect between, say, a tonic and a supertonic scale degree in a corpus. In the experiment that you're looking at, we hypothesized that there would be a 2/3 effect size of tapping on the more frequently heard tone of the tritone, right? Which reflected the amount, the fact that they heard one of the notes two-thirds times more. And so we basically expected that their behavior would track the exposure rate, predict that 2/3 of the time the participants would respond by tapping on that as the strong beat.
So, or rather, 1/3 of the participants would not respond as expected to this priming.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then the 80% that you're referring to is we were expecting people to audiate the more frequent pitch 80% of the time. And this is just sort of mystical wizardry here. It seemed like an easy task, and so I hypothesized 80% of the time. I mean, the thing about predicting effect sizes is that my impression is that there's not as strong a tradition around exactly how to do it, as opposed to like finding a p-value. We know exactly how to find p-values. How to predict an effect size is a little like what's your gut about it, but also like, can you find, let's say, some corpus evidence to support a particular hypothesized effect size or something like that?
I feel like we know what p-value means more in the sense that, you know, if we go with a, you know, 95% confidence that, you know, that this is not chance, right? Whereas I don't know that, again, you guys are probably both more well-versed in statistics than I am, but I don't know that tracking effect size directly to your stimulus like that is necessarily, is that necessarily going to correlate exactly as you're describing? I mean,
no, I wouldn't. I mean, but the question is, like, unless you're just relying entirely on your own intuition or pilot studies, you want to find some other kind of pillar to moor that number to. And so in this case, I was just attaching my effect size to something about the exposure.
Effect sizes become more manageable when there's a tradition, right? And I think it's daunting here because not only did you take the care of setting effect sizes in terms of how you articulated these studies, you didn't get significant results. And so it doesn't really tell you anything about how reasonable that effect size was. It was just simply you didn't make it and you don't know why. although, I mean, looking at the numbers involved, it still challenges assumptions and intuitions we have about the importance of the influence of tonal hierarchy on the establishment of metrical hierarchy, because the results are so ambiguous that obviously a large proportion of the participants were not responding as expected. And I think that that's important to keep in mind. Often when we talk about these ideas of how rules define our perception, it's easy to assume that the rules are deterministic and that A makes B happen. And here, it's very clear that it's not deterministic. And so even if there is a slight influence, and that influence might be more subtle than can be captured by this particular design, maybe if you could find a slight effect by having a larger population and maybe a less ambitious effect size, there's still a large number of people that did not behave as expected, given this rule-based approach that's encouraged by music theory thinking for these kinds of processes.
Yeah, no, that's a really good way of putting it, yeah.
Another thing that you looked at was interactions between your conditions as well as different population things. And I have to ask, because it really baffled me, why did you test gender as a factor for these results? Why?
No, that's a really great question. It seems like in music cognition literature, there is a history of using gender in your ANOVAs. I suspect that it's because we once got gender results, you know, back in the 1970s. And so now everybody like tests gender. And I don't think that we should. I just think that it's a thing that has a history of being tested, and so I include it. So what I added it in for was because if you have a robust enough effect, then it should withstand in an analysis of variance. It should withstand adding another random factor. What gender actually does positively for us is if your effect is so fragile that it can't withstand being divided up by gender, then you don't have a good effect. Mm-hmm. And so that is one thing that gender does for us.
I think there's a confusion here that's in a lot of cognitive psychology studies, in that there's an importance of reporting the diversity of your population. You know, we need to recognize how there might be biases in our population. And so, for example, the group of subjects that you're working with were music students that had a lot of experience with the type of music theoretical constructs that you were evaluating. And so that was an important bias to include and to articulate. Similarly, in reporting gender, it's a way of saying we weren't somehow including a bias towards one particular group of people that might correlate with gender. And I think it's important to articulate ways in which you're maybe deliberately resisting a bias in your population, but that doesn't mean that you have to test it specifically unless you have a hypothesis that goes along with that difference.
No, that's absolutely reasonable. So there's two things that that I think underlie, and I don't want to say that I believe either of them. One of them is that you could imagine getting different results for people whose voices are pitched differently. If exposure to certain levels of pitch makes you prefer higher notes over lower notes, let's say, then gender is an important factor, right? Potentially. The other thing is that you'll notice that I used gender identity on this, whereas the tradition is something closer to the concept of sex, right? And so there's something even more arbitrary about the fact that I test for gender identity as opposed to sex. Because there it's a identity that has really very little to do with your musical background or anything like that, which I think is what you're getting at, Finn, right? It's interesting that this came up because I remember thinking that it was a kind of silly thing for me to be asking about, then shrugging my shoulders, using it in the statistical analysis, and thinking it would be an interesting project to look at the history of asking about gender and sex in music cognition work, because it does seem to come up more than you think that it ought to. Yeah.
I have to admit that in the studies that I've done, I always ask it in my preamble questionnaire, and And I've only done it because it's, as you say, Chris, it's just kind of what people have always done. And I haven't thought a lot about why.
And as a non-binary person myself, it's very awkward.
Sure, of course it is.
Because I really wish that people would articulate specifically what they think the issue is. I mean, if, for example, it is a question of frequency exposure, you know, my voice is in a particular register, and so then it would make sense to answer a question that related to that particular issue and not talk about gender. I mean, it seems like a correlate to the question rather than a specific useful criteria. And to be honest, if you wanted to have an arbitrary division of your population to test, you could just arbitrarily divide your population and test them in two groups. You could be, you know, the people that came in the first half versus the second half. You could have alternating assignments of numbers and then test that instead. And that would serve the same purpose in terms of challenging the validity maybe of any kind of significant result. But using gender specifically suggests that there's a relationship when there needed to be one.
Oh my God. Yeah. You know, you're just blowing my mind a little bit here. Like, that's exactly right. I don't know why we do this. Unless we're unless the study is about gender, why are we bothering with this question?
Even in terms of like the arbitrary division, if you ask, as I did, male, female, or prefer not to respond / gender queer, you're going to get, you know, about, you know, a like 48-48-2 or something like that. And so it's actually not going to be a good arbitrary division because it's not going to equally divide your population, right?
Because there's a growing prominence of people that aren't in that binary. So you got to figure out something else.
We've gotten kind of far afield from Chris's study, but this is really important. I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about experiment 4 because we haven't at all yet. This one was like my favorite. Obviously, you know, it was the one that came with significant results, but I also just thought it was really encouraging to see something that sort of put metrical hierarchy on a higher status than tonal hierarchy.
So maybe walk us through the experiment. So someone comes in to your lab, you sit them down in front of the computer, and then what happens?
What happens is, well, they'll do all this as a practice before it's recorded, but this is the sequence. They hear, let's say, C, D, C, D, C, D, but, you know, it can be transposed to any pitch level, and one of them's going to be louder than the other. Then they have the choice of three dominant sevenths that they get to hear when they press particular keys on the keyboard. So I believe in this case the number three gave them a F7, the number 4 gave them a G7, and the number 5 gave them a B-flat 7, if they're listening to CD, CD, CD.
Okay.
And so they're instructed to press those numbers, and they can press them as many times as they want in whatever order. They're just like listening to those dominant sevenths and choosing which one harmonizes that oscillating pulse that best. The oscillating pulse occurs throughout the entire thing. So you're hearing CD, 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 CD while you're pressing those dominant sevenths. So they're hearing them, the melody, that, you know, quote melody, being harmonized by those three different dominant sevenths.
And then they decide in the end which of those three is the best?
Yes. Yeah, that by pressing shift number, they end that trial by choosing that dominant seventh.
Okay. That's very interesting. Okay. And then they do this a number of times, right?
Three times in this one. When I've rerun this experiment, I've increased it to 5 times.
I was also just wondering, I know that I skimmed through the Davy Temperley's response to the paper. He was curious as to why the sort of number of samples was so small for each participant.
That was I wouldn't call it a mistake on my part, because I don't want to.
Right.
But I should, okay. I should have done more trials per person and to get a clearer understanding of what was going on. I'm also as I said before, I really like to make my experiments short so that I can get people to come in and just do a little quick trial as they're going between classes, right?
Whenever I do mine, I'm on the opposite end. I end up like borderline, you know, abusing my participants by making them do like 90 trials of the same thing. And I worry, you know, about people getting bored or this or that, but usually the it all kind of comes out in the wash because you get enough trials that you still get an effect. But yeah, that was something that I was curious about throughout.
When I've redesigned these formats, I've increased the size. So I'm using 5 trials right now in the way that in my designs.
And then in that case, are you getting like the attendancy per participant then over your 5 trials and then representing that way as you evaluate? Okay, as opposed to looking at what they did the first time and the second time and the third, which is
in this paper, right? Every trial is its own data point, whereas a more statistically robust way of looking at it is the ratio of times that an individual participant. So each participant is a data point. Yeah.
This is a lot of speculation. So forgive me, but I was thinking about how ambiguous tonality works, and you know, in teaching, tonally ambiguous music in the 20th century or popular music or something like that, where we have to sort of establish tonal centers by means other than, you know, the tonal hierarchy, but by means other than cadences and things like that. If this kind of informs that approach in a way, you know, if we think about, okay, well, duration or metrical accent, or these are the kinds of things that make us decide what a tonic is in, say, a pop music song that has a 4-chord shuttle where the tonic isn't really established by some sort of harmonic relationship. That's where this jumped out for me in that context, actually, maybe that's really how we're thinking about these types of things when we listen to a kind of tonally ambiguous 4-measure chord loop or something like that.
Yeah, that seems right. And the way that I think about it in my head is we don't have to wait for 4 measures of, you know, of a piece of music to know what key something is in. We know what key something is in pretty quickly. Before, you know, you get all 7 pitches of the diatonic scale or something, it seems like, right in the initial seconds of listening to a piece of music, you know what key it's in. And it seems like in order for that to be true, you need to use something more than just the distribution of pitch classes that's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And if that's true, then you have to bring in things like meter or like chord type, something that's more than just counting your pitch classes. And I mean, here we're getting into
melodic motion.
Yes, right.
Duration.
Yeah, we're getting into the like argument between key profiles and people that don't believe in key profiles.
Right.
It's a good argument.
Yeah. a lot of this work comes out of my skepticism of whether key profiles are actually the most representative way of capturing human cognition of tonal centers.
Mm-hmm.
And my intuition is that meter plays a much stronger role than we usually give it credit for. And vertical harmony, I think, gives it a lot more, much stronger role than we give it credit for. This is sort of all part of that larger project.
Yeah.
I wonder, like, I'm thinking about some of David Huron's book, Sweet Anticipation, and how he talks about imagined tonality, right? Like if you sort of imagine a tone, that you're going to also imagine that tone to be the tonic. And so these like little very quick bits of evidence that we get are more likely to confirm the imagined tonic than something like a cadence or hearing all 7 notes of the diatonic scale that are in play. The piece of music starts and we imagine, oh, this is going to be the tonic. Then the first couple of chords we hear, if they're in metrically strong places, that's going to immediately sort of tonally orient our listening before we get to a cadence or anything like that.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Just as you were saying how the imagined note is generally the tonic, I was just imagining a note and I'm like, no, that's the leading tone. I'm imagining a leading tone right now. So I think it says something about the context in which...
Sure.
That imagining happens is so important, and we can bring that, we can impose a context no matter sort of what we imagine. Yeah. So you've done a little bit of follow-up studies then on this. Are you taking this work further?
Yeah. So I reran the last experiment here using 5 trials, and I basically replicated this. I think I made a big deal in this paper about how... if you chose B flat at a particular place, then it makes you change if you choose B flat in the second trial, you're more likely to hold it on your third trial, something like that. That effect actually falls away. But what's interesting about it is that there is a clear preference, an even clearer preference when you do this with five trials, for aligning the metrically emphasized pitch with a chord tone. But the other thing that I did was I did it with not just a loudness emphasized pulse stream, but I asked participants to either tap their foot or conduct and then do the test, or I gave them a notation where they see the melody and they see it notated as one of the as either the higher or the lower note, a downbeat in beats of two, in measures of 2/4. And what I found was the tapping the foot or conducting does have a strong effect, almost as strong as loudness. However, notation doesn't. That's what we found on our follow-ups.
That makes sense.
How good a sight reader are your students at this point?
That's a good question, but like it is just an oscillating whole step. So you'd imagine that even if you're not a great sight reader, but the question is well taken because it's, you want to know whether they're actually internalizing what they're reading.
That's exactly it.
Yeah, you could imagine if I had asked them to like sing it first, maybe it would have internalized it more, and I would have gotten a strong effect. The other follow-ups is that I've done this experiment with chords instead of with just monophonic little whole steps. And I get an effect.
The first three studies you've done with chords now.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
So asking the question, does knowing the key help you know what your meter is? And so let's say you have a C major context and I play you a G chord going to an A minor chord oscillating between those two. People much prefer the chords that occur more frequently in corpora to chords that occur less frequently and prefer to attach accent to them.
You're saying that the tapping task that was ambiguous when you were just giving melodies became much more effective in terms of establishing a metrical hierarchy when you're including a full chord that had a clear role.
Yeah.
Okay. So the notes by themselves weren't enough, but the chords did then help impose a metrical hierarchy.
Could that be because for the same sort of reasons we were talking about, maybe the ambiguity of imagining a harmonization? Then that ambiguity is taken away.
Yeah.
You know, if you're seeing, if you're alternating C and D, right, as seen in the fourth experiment, you can imagine those notes to be in any number of key contexts. But if you're playing G major to A minor over and over again, that's only going to come up in a couple of key contexts and will be informed by your statistical exposure to the corpora, as you mentioned, right?
My impression is that your tonal expectations are activated more by chords than they are by melodies, which is
fair.
Yeah, right. And so I think that in this paper, what comes out is that melodies don't actually activate tonal expectation, at least tonal expectation enough to affect how you metrically entrain. And so I think what I'm finding is that knowing what key you're in does help know what your meter is. It's just that you need to use a really strong feeling of key, a really strong attachments to tonality to bring that effect out.
Right.
Those strong attachments being chord progressions.
And how large an effect are you getting in these studies then?
It depends on how you frame it. The largest effect that I've gotten is using the three most frequent chords on one pulse. That's the one chord, the four chord, the five chord. Those occur more than your two chord, your six chord, and your three chord. But then notice what happens. You get major chords going to minor chords. And so then the question is, do people just prefer to tap on and train to major chords as opposed to minor chords?
That's a big interaction with a lot of corpus stuff, though.
Yeah,
That's not something that can be untangled in these contexts.
It's really hard to untangle. One more experiment that we did, it's an exposure experiment, where people listened to fully diminished seventh and a stacked fifth chord. And one of them they heard far more frequently than the other. And so half of our people heard fully diminished sevenths more, and half of our people heard stacked fifths more. And then we alternate between those two and ask them to tap on which ones they hear is more accented. and they tap on the one that they've heard more.
Mm-hmm.
So the exposure worked.
Yeah, so there is actually out there the potential that exposure helps you know what your strong beats are, huh. Or frequency helps you know what strong beats are.
Wow, that really challenges then the interpretation that you put forward in this paper, because it seems like the amount of information sort of breaks the difference, whether it's ambiguous or whether it's clear. That really depends on the amount of information you're given about the tonal context, about what pitches are possible, about what else can be going along with the stimulus that you're presenting that you're supposed to tap with.
This is very exciting work, Chris.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, so I think that I would modify the conclusions that I put at the end of this paper to say that what actually matters is harmony itself. What is actually interacting with meter is harmonic stability, harmonic tonal stability, not just like abstract tonal stability.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Oh, that's really interesting. So I have to ask this question as we come to the end of this interview. How do you think this relates then to our experience of music today? Like if someone is listening to music, as they walk to work or whatever, where do these factors get involved with what they're doing?
One way that I think about like the so what of this project is that if we know that in order for harmony to express meter, in order for harmony to show us what the meter is, it has to do this, that, or the other thing. Like which is what I'm investigating here. Like,
mm-hmm.
And it's possible that that there are just some basic ground rules about the way that meter and harmony interact, and that they're still influencing the way that we compose music today.
Mm-hmm.
That if a pop musician like wants to show strung beats with a particular kind of harmonic progression, they are constrained by these particular kinds of parameters. So that's one reason that I think that this is important, is because it tells us the way that music is still being composed. It's not just like mm-hmm. the way that Mozart did it or the way that mm-hmm. Haydn did it. It's the way that music and harmony interact mm-hmm. still today.
Okay.
Chris, can I ask unfair question?
yeah. Oh, those are the best kind, right?
Well, I know because you haven't designed an experiment that deals with this, but what do you think triple meter would do to these results? You would have to reimagine how the experiment was designed, obviously, but if you set up a paradigm in which you had sort of various notes becoming the sort of downbeat of a triple meter, how would that change things? I feel like it might be too easy of a task then, like there wouldn't be enough ambiguity, but I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, the reason that I chose duple is because it's such a clear forced choice. It's binary.
Yeah.
Option. When you get into threes, obviously there's three possible places that the strung beat should be.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could also imagine a experiment where you say, hey, group it into threes or twos, and then you increase the, put mm-hmm. potential responses even higher than that. Oh, and the other thing about threes is that what I really didn't want to happen was people to choose a pulse based on some grouping characteristic, like if they heard something go, high, low, low,
right,
or something like that.
It just complicates it, yeah.
So getting into threes, you would more often have people like recognize that there's a different thing happening every three pulses, and so therefore that grouping is why I'm choosing this pulse, not because of the event itself.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought I would throw it out there.
triple
meter seems to get overlooked a lot in meter studies and empirical research anyway.
Yeah, I think it's just because it's hard, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's exactly it.
There's so many different things we can do with triple meter.
Yeah.
And yeah, meter, not quite as simple as we'd like it to be.
maybe that should be the title of this podcast, meter : never as simple as we want it to be.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for giving us all your time. And this was a really interesting paper. And I think we got into some pretty fundamental issues in the process.
Yeah.
you're digging at some important stuff here. So good luck with your ongoing work on this, too.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for coming on, Chris.
This was really fun.
It absolutely was.
Yeah, thanks for talking to me. All right. I'll see you all later.
So, wow, we covered a lot of stuff with Chris.
We really did.
Maybe just getting back to the paper, could you summarize this one last time?
Sure. So Chris's paper was interested in finding out the interactions between metrical and tonal hierarchies, and he did so by way of four experiments. The first three had participants tapping to essentially oscillating two pitches. In the first experiment, those two pitches were contextualized by a tonal context so that one of them would be more stable than the others. And he hypothesized that more stable, tonally stable pitches would be tapped upon more frequently than the less stable pitch, but found that that was not the case. And in the second experiment, Chris created essentially a novel grammar by way of an exposure. So the pitches that the hierarchy was essentially created by an exposure phase in which one of the pitches was heard three times more than the other. And then the hypothesis in that second experiment was that the one that was had more exposure would be tapped upon more often as the strong beat than the other pitch. But there were no significant results in that study either. In the third study, Chris did a similar approach to the second study, but in this case using diminished seventh chord context, again, tonally ambiguous, and then created a stable pitch based on exposure and found, again, that not to have any significant effect. And then in the fourth experiment, Chris sort of flipped the paradigm and created a stability based on a metrical emphasis of the first or second pitch, the C or the D. And then participants were asked to harmonize the oscillating pitches based on one of three dominant seventh chords. And what he found was really interesting in that the metrical emphasis on the oscillating pitch informed participants' choice of which dominant seventh chord to harmonize the oscillating pitches with. So if more metrically strong pitches were chosen to be harmonized by dominant seventh chords that aligned with those metrically strong pitches rather than the weak ones. I think I've got all of that. Is that about right?
Yeah, I think that's all of the pieces there.
Okay.
And so within that paper, the fact that tonal stability didn't give strong priming effects to the selection of what was a downbeat in a alternating sequence, that was taken to be an absence of a tonal stability being a determination on how metrical hierarchy was perceived, whereas the last experiment showed that there was a relationship between metrical hierarchy and what's perceived to be tonally strong or tonally appropriate. So that it suggested a one-directional effect between tonal hierarchy and metrical hierarchy.
A one-directional effect that is sort of opposite to what music theorists might have expected, I will add.
Yes. And then since then, we've learned that he's done studies that have found a different kind of relationship between tonal hierarchy and metrical hierarchy, in that when giving people chord sequences, alternating chord sequences, tonality does seem to be a much stronger prime for inferring which note is the downbeat. So
right.
That goes back to what people expect from
right.
Theory.
Right. And we, the three of us sort of speculated that might have to do with the lack of ambiguity. When we imagine, you know, a monophonic context, there's potential for participants to kind of imagine varying harmonic contexts. Mm-hmm. And when you eliminate that potential, it sort of sways back in tonality's favor, which is a really interesting result.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Were there any other surprises that came up as we talked about the experiments and everything else in that long discussion?
Yeah, I just think the design was really, really interesting and creative. And I was very surprised that tonality didn't have a larger effect. Mm-hmm. Overall, I don't know that we have the full story yet. As Chris was mentioning, his follow-up studies seem to push things more toward tonality again. But then how do we, you know, there's lots of music that's monophonic and that lacks that kind of tonal context in such an explicit way. And so how do we sort of deal with those results in comparison with this earlier study in considering that? I don't know that we can kind of make any bold claims at this point.
These stimuli were examples of music that were pretty thin in terms of information, right?
Right. Intentionally so, I think.
Yeah, intentionally so. And so comparing that to the experience of music in a more sort of naturalistic setting, there is a lot of information that can go into how we orient in terms of meter and how we orient in terms of tonality to understand, you know, the notes as they go by, or the events right. in the music as they go by. And so, I mean, I think that that's a question of like what wins in terms of maybe resolving ambiguous contexts. But if we're thinking mm-hmm. of types of music that are generally monophonic, well, maybe the rules are different for that
yeah,
in terms of what exactly. maybe is standard sequences. Maybe there's all kinds of other cues. You know, I've been thinking of like folk music off the top of my head, and
sure.
often ornamentation is something that can come up at the beginning of a melody that, you know, to do like a grace note somewhere that would help inform what's going to continue to help orient a listener, even when there isn't any other notes sort of going by.
Yeah.
Maybe the rules yeah. are different for establishing this stuff when you have less information. And in these cases, you know, for those first three experiments, Chris really managed to make it ambiguous.
Yeah.
Whether he meant to or not, it was definitely ambiguous in terms of what people
yeah.
could do. They were free to infer whatever kind of metrical, impose whatever they wanted metrically to those sequences.
Yeah.
And that's a different kind of exciting result to have. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if I've harped on this too much, but I wanted to restate how important I think it is that we're doing this kind of work as it relates to music theory's assumptions.
Mm.
Because so much of what we pass down to musicians, you know, we don't question it enough. And I think that this kind of work gets at those things and often reveals very surprising results, as we found in Chris's work here.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I just think that that's really, really important, and that hopefully people will keep doing this kind of stuff.
For sure.
So,
all right. If I have my way, they will. I don't know.
Me too. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that I'm interested in and
yeah.
that I'm doing. So, and I hope to continue to do. But
super.
But I guess maybe what I'm saying is I hope that it maybe reaches beyond the music science community a little bit more
mm-hmm.
And into sort of the music theory world, or even further just into the music teaching world
mm-hmm.
and kind of makes an impact in that regard, because so much of what we pass down is just like sort of assumed, presumed to be true, presumed to sort of this is the way music works. Don't question it. And I think that that can be problematic.
Yeah. All right. Well, this is it for this episode for the So Strangely podcast on recent research in music and science. If you want to get in touch, you can follow the podcast on Twitter at So Strangely Pod. You can find us on Facebook at the So Strangely Podcast, and check out the website or the blog at sostrangely.com. And if you're a music science academic and you have your hands on a new publication that you really think people should hear about, get in touch so we can maybe make that happen. So drop us a line through the contact form at sostrangely.com/contact, or email me directly at finn@sostrangely.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep digging into the how and why music sometimes behaves so strangely.
Sometimes behaves so strangely. Sometimes behaves so strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely. So strangely.